Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Everybody, my name's Sue Supriano, and I'm going to be speaking here with Kevin Danaher today. Kevin Danaher is a co-founder of Global Exchange, an activist, and author. His most recent book is called Corporations Are Going to Get Your Mama, Globalization and the Downsizing of the American Dream. I'm looking at another book here called 50 Years is Enough, The Case Against the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And he's also written some books on South Africa. But we're going to be concentrating here today on these economic issues of globalization and how they work and how they're affecting all of us, because this is, needless to say, very important. So welcome, Kevin. And let's see, where shall we start? We've been talking about the policymakers.
Yeah. Now, we have now a global economy that has institutions that make rules for the entire planet. This is relatively recent in world history. The World Trade Organization is responsible for working out the rules of international commerce. The World Bank is the major lender, the major multilateral government-based lender to mostly third world governments. And the International Monetary Fund, which started out trying to balance world trade by helping out with loans to countries that were experiencing temporary balance of payments deficits, has now become sort of a policy enforcer. Both the World Bank and the IMF are now in a position where they can go to third world governments that are in debt and say, okay, if you want any new money to help pay off your old debts, you've got to implement policies that we dictate to you. And basically what these policies are about, they're referred to oftentimes as structural adjustment. What they amount to is opening your country up to the penetration of foreign corporations and letting those corporations get, one, your workers at low wages, no unions, thank you very much, and two, your environment. Let us take away your natural resources, cut down your trees, catch your fish, pull up your minerals out of the ground, etc., and not put a lot of restrictions on it, not inhibit the profit making. So what you see going on is these governmentally based institutions like the World Trade Organization, the IMF, and the World Bank act as sort of the policy environment creators, the icebreakers that go in and beat up the governments in one way or another, using financial mechanisms to soften them up to say, okay, now we want you to let these corporations come in and do whatever the hell they want. And the corporations come in behind the IMF, World Bank, and the WTO.
I want to tell people that if you think that these names of these big institutions and these faraway places don't have anything to do with you, that's not true. So even though, and I'm realizing I've heard about these institutions, I know about them. In fact, I always say whenever the IMF is involved, we know that 100% of the time it makes things worse for people. It's just very straightforward. It always makes things worse. But it could very well sound very remote to the average person. But it does indeed affect all of us on a very day-to-day level. So don't give up, don't tune out with these big words, not big words, but, you know, institutions that sound so distant.
Right. Well, there are examples in recent history. The World Trade Organization, for example, ruled the United States environmental movement, pressured Congress to enact a special section of our Endangered Species Act to protect endangered sea turtles who were being killed by companies catching shrimp with nets, fine mesh nets, that they drag them for 5-6 hours at a time. The sea turtles get caught in them. They can't get out. They're air breathers. They can't get to the surface. They die. There's a sea turtle dying about every 10 minutes on average from these shrimp boats. And the sea turtles, I mean, you got to remember, the sea turtles have been here for 150 million years. They predate the dinosaurs. They've been swimming the face of the earth for that many years. So what right do we as a species have to kill off this species that predates the dinosaurs? So people went, they created this law saying any company that is using these kind of nets that doesn't have a turtle excluder device, it only costs $400 to put a turtle excluder device. It's a metal grate that lets the shrimp go through, but it catches the sea turtle and kicks it out a side door and saves the sea turtle. Companies that didn't want to put those turtle excluder devices in their nets, you can't sell your shrimp here in the U.S. market. Well, the countries, several Asian countries where some of these fishing companies were based, went to the World Trade Organization, which is sort of the supreme court of the global economy. It rules on what is free trade and what is not.
Not exactly self-appointed, but
they're unelected. I mean, nobody even knows who these people are. They're three-judge tribunals who they're usually corporate lawyers that make the decisions. So it's kind of questionable, you know, where the environment and human rights is going to come out, where all the judges making the decisions come out of a corporate background and their main thing is profit making for the companies. So anyway, the World Trade Organization issues a ruling that the U.S. government is violating principles of free trade by having this environmental restriction on access to its shrimp market, and the United States has to take away that, has to rescind that law, or be forced to pay financial penalties. That's happened in the case of Caribbean banana farmers. It's happened in the case in terms of air quality from gasoline, where we had to rewrite our air quality standards because Venezuelan petroleum companies that were selling dirtier gas in the United States than was allowed by the EPA went to the World Trade Organization. World Trade Organization says those clean air rules are a violation of free trade principles. It happened in the dolphin tuna case. You have a whole long list of cases where not just the United States, but other countries, environmental standards and worker protection standards have been lowered, have been degraded because of rulings by this organization based in Geneva, Switzerland, that most people don't know about, at least up until last November 30th, they didn't know about it. And that's what those protests were about up in Seattle. And that's why I think it was a historical turning point, because you had environmentalists and trade unionists and small farmers and human rights activists, all sorts of sectors, all sorts of constituencies represented, coming together saying, look, if there's going to be rules made for the global economy and there's going to be some institution that's passing judgment on what's fair and what's not, well, two things. One, we've got to ask who's sitting at the table making those rules. Is it a bunch of rich white males coming from a corporate perspective, or is it the bouquet that is humanity with the diversity that should be at that table? And two, what kind of rules are they passing? Is it rules to maximize corporate profits and turn nature into money? Or is it going to be rules to sustain the environment and support human rights? And I think if we go out and we educate the public about these issues, and we present those choices to the public, the majority of the public is going to be on our side and is not going to choose maximizing corporate profits as the be-all and end-all for global policy.
Right. And also I think that people don't even begin to understand, because of course the media, and I say this in practically every interview I do, the media is also owned by a very few corporations whose interest is making money, making profits. So they don't really happy to give us the information that we need to have. And we are in very serious trouble on this planet environmentally.
One of the things that we always try to point out to people about the corporate-owned media is that there's a confusion out there in the public, and the defenders of the system always use this confusion. They say, oh, well, if you don't like the New York Times, don't buy it, and they'll be forced to change, you know, this kind of nonsense. Well, if you look at a newspaper or a magazine or commercial radio or commercial TV, it's not you, the consumer, that's paying for it. When you put 25 cents in a newspaper box for your local newspaper, that doesn't pay for that newspaper. That newspaper costs $5, $6, $7 to produce. What's paying for that newspaper is the advertising. That's why most pages, when you open up, 90%, 80% of the page is some Macy's ad, and then there's a little bit of news stuck in at the top. In fact, I used to do layout on a newspaper many years ago, and we would always lay out the advertising first, and what was left was called the news hole. And it tells you what the priorities are. So then you realize, okay, wait a minute, we're not the consumers. It's the corporate advertisers who are the consumers. Well, then what's the product? It's not the tires and the toothpaste and the ads. It's us. Our minds, our values, we are the product. We are being marketed to the corporate advertisers. So when people say, oh, television is vacuous, there's no content, well, that's by design. They don't want people to think. They don't want people to have critical consciousness. That would undo the whole system. So I liken it to slavery. Slavery was the marketing of human bodies. And it was easy to see that it was wrong because you've got somebody standing up in an auction block and they're poking him and looking at his teeth and saying, okay, this person's for sale. Well, what the corporations are doing with us, with our consciousness, is even more insidious because they're selling access to our minds, to the shaping of our values. Our children are sitting in front of TV sets being taught that what's important is the possession of things rather than the quality of your social relationships. So the one is a quantitative measure of how much stuff do you own. And what we're counterposing to that is, no, wait a minute. We need to have a revolution of values and have our children grow up believing that what's important is the quality of social relationships. Do you love other people? Do they love you? Do you know your neighbors? Do you have a community? Do you have a good school? Do you have a good job? When you wake up on Monday morning, do you want to go to work or do you hate going to work? You know, these are the basic questions, not what kind of jeans do you wear and what kind of shampoo do you buy and what kind of car do you drive. This is a propaganda brainwashing that's been carried out by the corporate media to get us on this treadmill of getting in debt and buying the commodities. And most people would rather go to the mall than go out and vote. So we've got a real crisis of democracy in our society that we need to ask these really basic questions.
Yeah. Well, I think you were going to expand some more too, Kevin, on the issue of democracy and this policy making. And I want to just tell people that at the end of the show we're going to be giving, as we always do, information, contact information for Global Exchange and Kevin Danaher and more information and all the many, many projects that Global Exchange does. But back to this issue of democracy.
Yeah, I think it's really important to go back to, with a lot of these terms, go back to the basic roots of the term. The word democracy comes from two Greek roots, demos, which means people, like demography, and kratos, K-R-A-T-O-S, which means rule. So the word means people rule. What we've got is we've got corporations ruling. So the big question, whether it's biotechnology and food or the World Trade Organization or factories shutting down here and moving to China or whatever the question, the big question is who rules, who governs, and who should govern? We had testimony out here recently in Oakland, California, to the Food and Drug Administration, where they are having hearings about biotechnology, bioengineered food. And I got to testify, and I said, look, I don't think this is about science, and it's not about biotechnology. It's about who governs. It's about who makes the rules. And are you a federal agency, federal employees, where we, the taxpayers, pay your salary, and you are public servants, supposedly working in the public interest? Is your job to protect the public or to protect the profits of corporations? And unfortunately, we know what the answer to that is in terms of what they're doing. But the question is, what should they be doing? So this calls for a real shift in terms of people's attitudes toward where does sovereignty, ultimate political authority, where does it reside? Under our system of government, sovereignty, ultimate political power, is supposed to reside in the people. It's not supposed to reside in corporations. Corporations are this fiction that's created, you know, this legal entity that now rules over us, that we created hundreds of years ago, and now they rule us. They define what our values are. They define what kind of food we're going to eat, the shape of our cities, the fact that most of our cities are dominated by the needs of the auto industry. And if we come out and propose 5 streets in San Francisco be for bikes and pedestrians, oh, that's an outrageous demand. Well, what about half of the roads being for pedestrians and bicycles and half for the auto industry? I mean, where did we get into this rut of thinking that the corporations can tell us how we can structure our lives? Now, at Global Exchange, one of the main ways that we focus this work is looking at the global economy, at the big picture, and focusing on these institutions like the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. These are unelected bureaucrats, unaccountable to the people, working in the interests of big corporations and banks. And what they do mainly, their main function, is to link the interests of first world elites, Washington and Wall Street, with the interests of third world elites, and get them collaborating on ruling over the majority in each of their countries. And the deal basically works like this. They come in from the World Bank and the IMF to third world elites. They say, okay, we've got a package here worth $300 million. You sign on the dotted line, we'll give you $300 million. But you've got to implement these policies that we wrote in Washington and Wall Street. And what are the policies? The policies are to favor U.S. corporations and other big transnational corporations coming in and extracting the wealth, the labor power, and the natural resources of those countries. And in return, those elites are allowed to have weaponry and are allowed to repress their people and not allow trade unions. And the U.S. government will cover them when the vote comes up to condemn them in the United Nations. And there's this nice little transnational elite alliance so that they can exploit the majority at both ends. So what we've got to look at is, one, how do we divide their unity, drive wedges into the unity between first world elites and third world elites, and bust up these institutions like the WTO and the World Bank and the IMF. But then on the other hand, at the grassroots side, how do we build the grassroots international alliance? We call it grassroots internationalism. How do we build grassroots internationalism and more unity at the majority level across national boundaries?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very well put. I wanted to say that oftentimes people think that the United States is helping poor people in other countries with their loans, for instance, with loans from the IMF and the World Bank. And in fact, most of the loans that the United States makes to other countries that come back to help the corporate particular are attached to actually corporations in the United States, or multinational corporations end up making more money, and they almost never help the people. And that's only one of the many, many misinformation that people have.
Well, in fact, when the Agency for International Development goes up to Congress, to Capitol Hill, each year to argue for its next year's budget, they make a very specific point of saying 2/3 of this money ends up back here in the United States to U.S. contractors, companies that go in and build the dams and the electric grids and all this. Well, if the money's ending up here in the United States, it's sure as hell not helping those people in those countries. And if you look at the structure, I think it's very useful to visualize a pyramid structure, a triangle structure. The people who are making the decisions and controlling policy and living in the wealthy neighborhoods and driving in limousines and benefiting from the system, they're at the top of the pyramid. They're a little triangle up in the top of the triangle. The rest of us are down in the base of the triangle, actually doing the work of the society. And then you've got connecting lines between the elites, the top of the triangle here, and the top of the triangle in Senegal and Indonesia and Mexico and Brazil and wherever. And they've got all sorts of little, if you thought of it like a rope is many little threads twisted together. So one thread would be an investment by General Electric in building a power plant. Another thread would be a deal from the Pentagon to provide weapons to that country's military. Another thread would be a World Bank loan or IMF structural adjustment program. All sorts of little connections. You even find connections when you study these countries in detail where the son or daughter of a State Department official in the U.S. marries a son or daughter of a Treasury Department official in some third world country.
You know, it's just like those kings and queens of all of in the past time.
Well, it's amazing the connections. Or they both their kids go to the same private schools in Paris. There's a very class sense of allegiance and solidarity among them, which we should learn from. We should have much more solidarity. When I hear people in the United States saying, you know, oh, those damn Koreans, they took our jobs or something like that. No, it's not the Koreans that took your jobs or the Chinese or the Brazilians. It's the companies who moved those factories. It wasn't those people who took the jobs. The fact that they're desperate for work and willing to work for a dollar an hour or something like that, that's not their fault. That's a product of the way the global economy is structured. So the bigger picture to look at, I think, is it took centuries to get separation of church and state. And now we're involved in the struggle to get separation of corporations and the state. We're trying to drive a wedge between money, capital, and governance. Because governance, if it's going to be democratic, has to be based on every individual human being having the same rights and the same say-so. Well, you know, and I know, and everybody knows, that if you have $10 million and I have $10 and we go to court in some battle, you can say, oh, well, the court is blind. It's a level playing field. Well, any fool knows that the person with $10 million is going to cream the person with $10. So we've got to, through various reforms like campaign finance reform, end of corporate welfare, getting the money out of politics, holding these candidates' feet to the fire about where does their money come from, what's their stand on corporate rule versus the people ruling. That's a way, I think, that we can really get at the heart of what's wrong with the system and why it's not really democratic. There was a democratic promise 200 years ago in the United States, and it's gradually been expanded to ex-slaves and women and people that were formerly excluded, but it hasn't fulfilled its promise of really having the people rule. We've got a system where the corporations rule, so we've got to figure out ways to get control back.
Yeah, and in fact, that gap is growing between in inequality, economic inequality, which brings all kinds of other inequality. I keep wanting some statistics. Well, I want people to know some statistics. I think and I know that Global Exchange has really been involved with the Gap, and it seems to me I heard that the head of the Gap makes $24,000 an hour, whereas the workers make 23 cents an hour, and there's a lot of those kind of examples.
Yeah. I'll give you two statistics that I find really useful. If you take the entire global economy, if you look at all expenditure on consumption, food and housing and clothing, and you look at the uneven distribution of it, the richest 20% of people in the world account for 86% of consumption. That means 80%, four-fifths of the population, gets 14%, not 40, 14% of global consumption. That's why there's children dying from hunger at a rate of 30,000 a day. Children dying from diseases where the vaccine costs 10 cents. That's inexcusable. It shouldn't happen. On the other hand, if you look at the United States, just so people don't think that we're exempt from it, the richest 1% of people in the United States own more property, stocks, bonds, and real estate, than the poorest 90%. The richest 1% own more property than the poorest 90%. Now, there's no way you're going to have real democracy when you've got that kind of extreme inequality. All this stuff about the stock market booming, the majority of Americans don't own stock. And then if you subtract from that 49% that do own stock, the ones who is just part of a passive retirement fund where they know nothing about the companies it's invested again, it's even a smaller percentage. It's only really the top 1 or 2% in the population who own the bulk of the stock. And for them, it's a casino. They've got millions and millions of dollars. They don't have to worry about paying a mortgage or, you know, pumping their own gas or going to the grocery store to buy groceries. Somebody else does that for them. Their servants do that for them. Those are the people who are making the rules of the society. So if you just stop and think about it for a minute, if the person who makes mass transportation policy, for example, never rides the bus, of course you're going to get bad mass transportation policy. If the person who makes housing policy lives in a mansion in a gated community, of course you're going to have homelessness. If the person who makes energy policy never pumps his own gas, of course you're going to have bad energy policy. And it goes right on down the line in every sector. The people making policy are isolated by their wealth and power from the majority of the population. So we get bad policy. And I don't care if you're left-wing, right-wing, moderate, whatever. That's just sociologically a bad structure of decision-making. Sociology 101 teaches you have to have a feedback loop where the people making policy feel some impact from the decision-making so that they can correct mistakes. If you have insulation in between them and the impact of the policy, you're going to continue to have bad policy. So you can call it a revolution, you can call it social change, reform, real democracy, whatever you want, but we got to make some real basic changes in the structure of power in the society.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. That's certainly my experience is that isolation of the policymakers. They don't even have a, because I know some of them sometimes, and they don't have a clue what it's like for most people. So what to do? You've got 3 minutes to solve the problems, Kevin Danner.
Well, we at Global Exchange, we have a whole bunch of different programs. We have a fair trade program where people can support the alternative economy. We have a fair trade coffee program where you can promote fair trade coffee out there. There's coffee everywhere. There's cafes everywhere. We have a program to pressure Starbucks to sign on to selling fair trade coffee instead of plantation coffee. We have reality tours where we can take you out to these different countries where you can meet grassroots activists. We have corporate accountability campaigns, like a campaign against the Gap that involves a lawsuit and demonstrations out in front of the Gap stores. Pretty much every town in the U.S. has a Gap store or an Old Navy or a Banana Republic. These are all companies that are exploiting people in sweatshops, and we have all the educational materials you need so people can check our website, which is www.globalexchange.org, real simple, globalexchange.org, or you can call our 800 number, which is 800-497-1994. That's 497-1994. If you get a tape machine, just leave your address, your name and address, clearly. We'll be happy to send newsletter, any kind of materials out to you free of charge. The movement is growing. We're getting a really good response from this, that people are realizing this is a new stage of history now with the new millennium, where we need to take the concept of democracy and expand it into the economic realm. If there's going to be institutions that are making rules for the global economy, they've got to be democratic. They've got to have average working class people involved in the process of making the rules for the global economy, or else we, the citizens of the planet, are not going to let them do it. And the most encouraging thing I see going on out there is people are getting beyond nationalism. They're starting to realize, wait, we got one planet, planet Earth, and we got one race, the human race. Let's go beyond the stage of nationalist thinking. Let's link up the grassroots majority around the world, and let's have global democracy and global prosperity and save the environment. We can do it. We can have a global economy with no starving children. It can be done.
So build our, you know, create our own alternative societies as we can. And what do you think about boycotts?
Well, we use a lot of boycott strategies in our work because these corporations are trying to sell products to us. And if we get together and organize, the key thing to remember is it's not you as an individual. It's being part of an organized movement. So if somebody just goes out on their own and say, I don't like this company, that's one thing. But if you're part of a movement, say with the Gap or Nike, where you're part of millions of people, it affects them. In the Nike campaign, Nike share price dropped from $75 a share to $45 a share. The executives lost millions of dollars. All of a sudden, they start changing their policies because of that pressure. That's the way it works. That's just the way it is. So we got to pressure them.
Yeah, and we can organize wherever we are.
Right.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Kevin Danaher from Global Exchange and author, most recent book, Corporations Are Going to Get Your Mama. I suppose you can get this all over around in bookstores?
We'd prefer that people buy it off our website or call us here at the office and buy it from us, but it is in your bookstores. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Kevin. My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.